what you say, because this podcast will appear in a couple of weeks on our website, boardoptions.com, and we'll be sending it out on LinkedIn. I would like to introduce the case writer for tonight's program and a friend of mine, George Neville. George and I first met when he was a partner at the late lamented Ernst & Young in EY. And George is now a retired partner at EY. And as when he was at EY, he was head of the New England region. And we were very proud that EY was a client of ours. George is a member of the board and chair of three public companies. There's EverQuote, Intapp, and Lumeratix. And then he's in the private company space. He's on the board of Wasabi, Equipnet, Cross Country Consulting. He's a senior advisor to Starlight Racing. And then when George has any time, he's the trustee at the Yawkey Foundation and with the Mass Mentoring Partnerships. So welcome, George.
Hello, everyone. It's great to connect. And I see my old partner, George Gorman, on the screen. So it's great to connect. But a number of faces I've seen through the years. So thank you, Larry, for including me.
And it's clear that George is basking in the sun in Florida while we are shivering here.
Short sleeves. Mm-hmm.
Group one was Angela, John, Larry, and Sanjeev. Have you got a spokesperson?
Yes, it's Angela.
Hi,
okay, Angela.
How are everyone? And the team will jump in if I miss anything. Okay, so quick summary. Diversified Technologies. It's a public company. They were on about $1 billion in growth. They were on a fast rise. They had the best technology, some of the best technology in their industry. However, they stalled. They didn't have a plan at the time of how to continue this fast growth. Our view is that they probably had lost focus on some of the processes, including the product and especially the financial controls processes. Mm-hmm. They were so focused on growth and looking good in the market. At some point, the SEC came in, but there were issues prior to this with some changes with the CFO, audit firms, all in the middle. So there was implications there were some issues in the financial controls, but they kept focus on the products. So revenue recognition became the major issue when the SEC mm-hmm. came in. So that's kind of where we are. The question leads us to where do we go from here? The CEO has a challenge with the new CFO, which came in sometime in the middle of the issue, has a different perspective than the audit firm mm-hmm. partner. The audit firm partner is focused on having a more aggressive plan to address some of the issues. Mm-hmm. The new CFO prefers, I guess, a less robust plan mm-hmm. is the way I would put it. Mm-hmm. So our team thought we should understand the perspectives from both the CFO and the audit partner. But in the middle of this, bring in a third party firm mm-hmm. to look at the varying sides of the issue. We mm-hmm. also agreed that we wanted to make sure that we were addressing a more robust plan, because not addressing the issues in the past, it got us to this point. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be some independence for the CEO to be able to save face. He doesn't want to look like he's not supporting the CFO, but at the same time, we need to thoroughly address the issues in the financial side of the business and the financial mm-hmm. controls, probably putting some different procedures in place, mm-hmm. ensuring revenue recognition policies are developed, and also identified throughout the company and adhere to. The other thing we talked about a little bit is looking on the product side to see what's slowing down the progress on the upgrades, because that I think may be a little bit pressuring this revenue recognition, although they were doing it wrong and calling it a warranty versus an upgrade. So that definitely has to change. So again, our group suggests that we have a third set of eyes look at the plan before we go forward to make sure that we've got everything and have a robust plan going forward. I'll defer to the team. Did I miss anything?
No, that was great. Thank you.
So, Angela, I gather from the sunlight streaming through the window that you're not in Boston. You must be in North Carolina.
I am in Raleigh, yes.
Raleigh. So why don't you introduce yourself, tell people a little bit about you.
Okay. Again, Raleigh, North Carolina. Lately, I spent a lot of my time entrepreneur with my husband. We've got us a couple businesses ourselves. I also spent a lot of time on boards. The board that's been keeping me most busy recently is a large hospital system board in Eastern North Carolina. I'm on their medical center board and their community hospital board and a few others. Nice. I spent most of my career in the technology business, a large global consulting. I ran a 30,000 almost $3 billion organization when I was with the company. So this revenue recognition case was kind of brought back a few nightmares for me, but being in a big public company, we were very, very conservative around revenue recognition, but I understand understand this particular issue most in very intimate detail.
Very nice. Very nice to have you.
Thank you.
Group two is Amita, George, Mark, and Robert.
I was elected the spokesman for group two. As you, Larry said, I have a background similar to George Neville, the author. I'm a former partner at EY also, although not in this space. So I would say our group agreed with the summary of the situation that Angela described. We focused in on pretty quickly that we've got this situation where the audit firm partner and the CFO agree on a problem, what needs to be done to fix it. But, you know, then as, you know, a member of the audit committee, presumably the chair, you get these two phone calls from the two parties saying they don't think each of them doesn't think the other is up to the task and essentially throwing each other under the bus. So one thing we focused on the CFO's call is she said she didn't think the audit partner was the right person to handle the restatement process. Well, that's not the audit firm's job. That's management's job. Management's responsible for the financial statements. So just working down that track a little bit, you know, this company seems like the CEO over the years has not invested in the finance department. They've had a lot of trouble. It may be under-resourced. And so we got to the same conclusion as Angela's team that, you know, they may need an outside consulting, you know, extra resources to help, you know, solve this problem that they all agree on. And you want to do it as efficiently and as correctly as possible, because you are not going to survive if you're a publicly held company, you've got a revenue recognition problem. If you, you know, start sending mixed signals out to the investment world, you're gonna die. Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, thought that you know, the board members should inform the CFO, probably in executive session or, you know, in a phone call about these two phone calls and talk to him. It's his problem to resolve. Mm-hmm. You know, keeping in mind noses in, fingers out. It's not us to get these two to play nice in the sandbox. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe she needs some executive coaching down the road. You know, we recognize that the CEO may have been, because of the management style, may have allowed this situation to deteriorate over the years, and question is he the, so then are we delegating to him the right, to negotiate between the audit partner and the CFO to get them to work together. But you know, that's a bigger question. Maybe this is not the right CEO, is, you know, for a problem for another day.
George, other than Ian Y, why don't you tell people a bit about what you've been up to?
Okay, let me just make one other thing on this. We also said that in addition to a consultant to help the CFO, that we think the company should have a really good PR crisis firm helping them on public communications. So that was our assessment. Anybody on the team want to add anything?
No, well done. Thank you.
Okay. So I, for the past 14 years, I've been a mutual fund of several different, an independent director of seven different mutual fund companies. One initially was a startup, which is a fascinating situation, from 2010 to 14. But then in 2014, I joined the board of the Eaton Vance Mutual Funds. We oversee, I was the audit compliance committee chair, then the audit committee chair, and I've been the board chair for a little over 2 years now. We oversee 135 funds, about 100 billion under management across all asset classes except money market funds. And, when I became the board chair, it was shortly after Morgan Stanley acquired Eaton Vance. So we've been working for 2 years on that integration and how it affects all of the operations of the investment business and how we work with Morgan Stanley as a new parent of our advisor. Mm. And it's been fascinating and it's a lot of fun.
One day that'll be a great case. I hope we can write it.
Yeah, it will.
Next group is Ingrid, Jim, Monica, and Phil.
Yeah, I've been designated to be the spokesperson for the group. First qualification is I'm nowhere near qualified to be the chair of an audit committee. I've tried to stay away from audit committees, but
Jim, we do not allow bragging.
Anyhow, looking at this, our analysis isn't unlike what others have said. However, the question that we're wrestling with is whether the audit partner is potentially a problem here. It seems like he's gotten two CFOs fired, or has gotten one CFO fired, and is in the process of trying to get the second CFO fired. And so one of the things that I might be inclined to do would be to try to make this a little bit of the audit firm's problem and get the audit firm to give us an independent perspective on this, maybe bring back the partner who had been there for 5 years and just rotate it off. So there's an issue, the dynamic issue there. You've already gone public with announcement to the SEC and so on. So I imagine you've got some legal advice, and I would draw that expertise in. We would draw that expertise in. And then the question is, it seems that there's potentially a stable that needs to be cleared out here, and that this has been around for a while. Mm-hmm. And the question the board at some level should be asking is the CEO the right person? Mm-hmm. Because this problem seems to have existed through two CFOs, there's a lack of attention there. I guess our recommendation would be do some analysis to figure out whether there's a whether we can sort out whether it's just a perspective issue between the two, whether they've got a broader issue there. Clearly you've got to make this management problem. The board can't fix it, but the question is, can management fix it? And, is it a broader and longer and deeper problem than just this one issue. And so we don't have a solution here. We've got a recommendation to dig further.
Jim, why don't you tell people a little bit about you?
Sure. I spent most of my career in the aerospace and defense industry, on the public side with a private company for 30 years that ended up being a part of Litton on its way to becoming part of Northrop when I went over into the not-for-profit space and went into Draper Laboratory, which is a national security-oriented independent not-for-profit that came out of MIT. And I was there for 14 years, 6 years as vice president of programs, 8 years as president. About 10 years ago, I hit a speed limit birthday and had to retire. And since then, I've been doing board and consulting work. I'm chair of the board of a national security and not-for-profit. I'm on the board of a characterized as a lifestyle company for PhD atmospheric chemists. So I tend to be in the technology space. And that's probably all you need to hear now.
Great. Thank you. Next group is Babs, John, and Susan. Anybody from Babs?
I'm doing the readout for the group.
Okay.
John, George, and Susan. And some of the insights that others provided, we had the same ones. We asked, why aren't the auditors finding the problems? Seems a bit odd. We said, why aren't the board asking the right questions? Why has this gone on for so long? And then Susan said they really should think about getting outside counsel or get a forensic. And we suspected there's something going on here because this high turn, whenever there's high turnover in the CFO's division, it's not a good thing, right? When people turn over frequently, I mean, other jobs, people turn over quickly, but how close are the CFO and the CEO? And some people in our group also brought up the point that Jim Shale's group brought up, is the CEO the right person at this time? I love George's comment. He said, it's kind of like Sergeant Schultz. Is everybody going, I see nothing, and pretending that they don't know what's going on? We talked about, as George Gorman's group talked about, they need a good PR firm. They need to take caution with the story that's going back to the investors. And what our George raised and John raised is, who is everybody answering to? You know, the audit's reporting to the board, the CFO is reporting. So there seems to be this triangle. And one of the learnings we had was that might've been created by Sarbanes-Oxley. So that triangle doesn't really help get things fixed. Mm-hmm. And what did I miss, team?
Oh, Babs, I think you hit on a lot.
Only thing I caught was, where was the chief risk officer?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, John, there you go.
So, Babs, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah. John or me?
No, Babs.
Oh, Babs. Please introduce Babs. Go back and tell us about skiing.
It's what we get for doing the scribing. So I'm Babs. I'm in Boston. I've been to 94 countries. I have a pile of patents. My best one made $800 million of incremental revenue. Most of them are in financial services. My last one was in insurance, loyalty programs. One's a lottery product, whatever. I work for a product development firm. I have been on audit committee, so I am familiar with this situation and many, many more. I spent 3 years on a board of directors of a $2.6 billion credit union and on the audit committee doing a CEO succession, a core tech conversion, two M&As, and replacing both auditors, both internal and external auditors, in the space of 3 years. And I golf and ski for fun.
Come on, Babs.
Don't forget the Harleys. That you buried the lead. That's really what you enjoy.
Our last group is Babs, Craig, Roberta, and Steve.
Yep.
Who's the spokesperson?
I think it was actually Brian. I think that was
yeah. Hey, I'm happy to field this. I think
you got to field promotion. Everything's Brian.
Everything's been pretty much discussed. I'll just add a couple thoughts that maybe haven't been discussed since I think we're going last. One was people brought up, hey, is this the right CEO? We also question, is this the right audit committee members? Like, is there some board issues going on here? What's our governance? How long they've been doing this? It sounds like they've been asleep at the wheel for years and years too. So we need to point the finger a little bit inward potentially there too. I think another thing that wasn't discussed but would be critically important is we do have to do this SEC filing. You know, we don't understand, at least I don't, the timing of that. So the importance of doing that as well as cleaning up all of the accounting moving forward so it never happens again, to keep it evergreen. So, you know, things that we're trying to avoid are litigation, delisting, things of that nature. So there's speed that needs to occur here. So people had talked about a third party moderator, et cetera. If we have the time for that, great. We at least set it minimum. Let's get the right people in the room, CFO, CEO, the audit committee, the CPA firm, and let's get more information to understand the nuances. Mm-hmm. And when we come forward with the plan, something that wasn't discussed, I think, by any of the other teams is, what is our profit growth story? Because buried into the case, it was evident that we're marginally profitable. If we're going to have to restate, there's a reason they did it the way they did it. So are we now all of a sudden going to restate and show that we haven't been profitable? Mm-hmm. So what's our story in association to that restatement? And we've got to be all over that, because my working hypothesis is maybe we haven't been profitable. Mm-hmm. And so what are we going to do to project out to the markets and the shareholders that we have a plan? And that goes into the PR firm. I think there is something there about how we're going to message this to kind of build trust with our shareholders, but also making sure whatever we do is sustainable. It's one thing to, you know, clean things up for the filing, but what are we going to do to keep it evergreen? And so I think that's critically important. That may need to come second, depending upon the timing and the speed at which this filing needs to occur to avoid, you know, litigation, delisting, and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. But I think those were the only nuances that we kind of captured that were beyond what everybody else has already discussed.
Thank you, Brian. Why don't you introduce yourself?
So Brian Wagner, many of you I do know, so pleasure to see you again. I am a healthcare executive, you know, 20 plus years, founding division of Boston Scientific. I've held a variety of C-suite level roles for companies like Philips and GE and Beck and Dickinson. At present, I have my own consulting firm where I do help small companies grow to become big. So I've been blessed to work for some of the greatest companies in the world and understand tools, process, best practices, and being able to apply those to smaller companies. Another passion of mine is creating dollars that otherwise don't exist. So really trying to do things disruptive in the healthcare world to improve patient care, reduce the cost to serve. At present, I sit on a board for a very unique company in the virtual reality space that focuses on education and training for medical devices. So being able to do that through virtual reality. I also am an advisor for a variety of other companies where I either audit the board or help them in their commercialization efforts or on their need to raise. But
thank you, Brian.
Meeting everybody again.
So let's move it to George. George, can you comment on the comments?
No, honestly. And, you know, I was writing them down just so I could make sure I pick up. And so whether I go last to first or what, please. But obviously, Angela and George G and both Jim and John and Babs and Susan Art group, along with Bob, Brian, your comments. You guys hit on a lot of the great points. And again, this is I kidded our group. So the dates are real. They're beyond the statute of limitations. So if anyone guesses what the name of the company is, I can't get in trouble. And there was a specific reason Larry changed the names for me on it. But this situation is really kind of not unusual as much as you might think it is. But Susan and Babs talked about it, and there's a triangle that exists that came out of kind of Sarbanes-Oxley that really re-emphasized or was meant to re-emphasize the role of the CPA, the audit firm, management, and this audit committee. And Jim, I love your comments that you don't think you're good enough to be on an audit committee. Unfortunately, I go back to a time when, you know, no one ever wanted to be on an audit committee. And most audit committees, particularly in the non-financial service industry and non-Fortune 500, were truly the committee no one wanted to go on. There was no such thing as a financial expert, which is now a defined term and requirements and all that. So it was really kind of the leftover committee. Oh, you'll go on audit. And the relationships, as I talk about the triangle, you know, management, audit committee, and the auditors, the relationship was really pretty much management and the auditors. So Enron comes around, unfortunately, many of us, Larry didn't share full disclosure. I was an ex-Anderson partner, 24 years down the tubes, as I tell people. And our biggest client back then was Enron. And it tells you what can happen when a client relationship sinks a, you know, $10, $20 billion organization. But Sarbanes-Oxley came in and created this mandates around who was going to do what where. And what it did is it put more pressure on the audit committee to really kind of step up and say, hey, listen, as Babs alluded to, the Enron audit committee alluded to that they were like Sergeant Schultz, right? We know nothing when all those financial derivatives and crazy things happen. Well, you know, that's unacceptable and it's not good practice anyway, but reality. So this triangle to work really requires everyone to understand their roles. Who do they have duty and care responsibilities to? And figuring a way of direct communication. So a couple observations that I think came through that were really good. The CEO and this business, I think Angela, you alluded to it with your revenue recognition concerns. You know, one of the reasons of, you know, having an issue with revenue rec is the company was able to get and report earnings by not calling upgrades and deferring revenue for it, by just saying, oh, it's warranty. We're just going to throw it in. Well, it separate from the accounting issue, it was systematic of a business issue that this company was having challenges getting their products, meeting deliverables, getting it out, getting customers to accept, whatever. And all you guys, all of you have been involved with businesses and know that's a recipe for disaster, right? So the underpinning is you wind up with a restatement, peel back the onion, you got underlying issues. The role of the CEO. You know, the CEO at the end of the day has a responsibility for the organization. He's empowered with that, he or she. And in this specific situation, you know, and again, this is a company that had a lot of things happening. As I just described, products weren't getting delivered on time. Customers are getting upset. They were getting competition in the marketplace, you know, revenue growth, single digits, you know, barely profitable before restatement, you know, employee turnover issues. He had a lot on his plate and trying to prioritize things. The last thing he needed to do was to, I didn't want to say beat up on the CFO and terminate the CFO, hold him accountable more. You know, he needed someone to be there with him to get through this, not just the restatement process, but in general. Again, company had a history of turnover. That's all ties back to tone at the top and culture. So comments about the CEO, what their role was, responsibility, whatever, totally on board. Audit committee, I think alluded to in the case, and now requirement that there be a financial expert fully engaged. This was an audit committee that heard the issues, but didn't want to deal with them. You know, kick the can down the road. CEO's got bigger priorities. You know, yeah, we're hearing the auditors. There's a lot of errors every year, but we've got 23,000 issues. That's lower on the list. And we'll play Russian roulette to see if we have a problem. Well, it caught up on them. But the audit committee clearly had heard these messaging. Again, auditors are, as a byproduct of Sarbanes-Oxley, they report to the audit committee and have to specific responsibilities of communications on errors, weaknesses and controls. So I can share with you the information was totally shared. But, you know, did they want to hold the CEO accountable? And where did the CEO put it on the list? And the issue was, you know, we'll deal with it when and if it becomes a problem. So I'll get to the restatement in a minute. Jim, you hit it, and it was a good point. You know, the auditor's got skin in the game. You know, George Gorman and I can appreciate that, you know, management's responsible for the financial statements and the preparation and presentation. But the end, you know, you're paying a lot of money to an auditor. An auditor's supposed to catch things. You know, did they miss things? Yeah, and, you know, we can all be judgment and jury. But, you know, the dynamic of how that relationship relative to communication, acceptance, hearing the comments, dealing with them, whatever, it was obvious that that triangle of communications was kind of broken. So great advice. And it wasn't done in this case, but was to bring in a third party. Even though the audit firm had recommended, management was reluctant. Management wanted to get the restatement over fast. And I think the points were made from a PR standpoint. You know, you got word out there, you got restated revenue automatically. The stock took a 30% decrease that next day. You got class action litigation coming up. You know, management team, they got business issues, right? So they want this thing just to move on. And now you got an auditor saying, you know, we're not going to do shortcuts. You're going to have to get this right. And what are you going to do? So, you know, bringing in a third party, and I think Susan made the comment, maybe actually also potentially be a legal independent counsel to just assess and advise the board independently to reaffirm their responsibilities, but also give them a fresh look and say, okay, this isn't, you know, everyone's got to play in the sand well, but how do we get this thing done, get it done right, do our fiduciary responsibility, to enable get this company to the next stage. So, you know, I think a lot of those were the comments that many of you raised. I think one question was raised, maybe it was Jim, by you, you know, get rid of the partner, bring back the old partner. Well, you know, unfortunately, the SEC rules are partners on for 5 years, they leave, can't come back for 5 years. So you would have had to bring another partner in. And the issue for the audit firm, and again, another, any of you who are involved with being on audit committees or hearing these messages when you're on other board meetings, the audit firm is also has a regulator looking over them right now. And prior to the Sarbanes-Oxley and the creation of something called the PCAOB, Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, audit firms audited each other. You know, Ernst & Young got audited by KPMG. KPMG got audited by Deloitte, names you've heard. But Sarbanes-Oxley put the PCAOB in place, a government regulators who the auditors, you know, get audited by, you know, it's de facto kind of like the IRS. But as anyone who knows, auditing has a lot of judgment. However, you can apply judgment all the way up and down the cycle as to what you think is reasonable. And a regulator can have a different point of view, which no different. I know there's a lot of FS people, financial service people on here. You appreciate that, whether it be the controllers or the FDIC or any of the other ones that kind of put pressure on. So you have a situation where, you know, Jim, to your point, go back to the firm and say, change the partner. Well, you know, the regulator actually monitors that stuff. And if there's an announced restatement and the client wants to change the partner, it basically becomes an SEC enforcement action. It gets thrown over. So the issue only gets worse for the company. So how do you kind of get either to play or not play? So, you know, I think those were a lot of the comments. Larry, did I miss any? that were kind of brought up. And please, before I tell you how things played out, which I know everyone loves to know what happened, which I will share, and it is a reality. But
George, a question I have, and I brought it up in our group, the growth profit story, you know, again, you got to restate, you got to go through all of this, but without having clarity as to how are we going to grow? I mean, nobody's going to invest. So how was that handled or how was that addressed? When they restated, were they less profitable, not profitable? Like, was that?
The prior years, Brian, they wound up going to loss and they had more revenue deferred out. But unfortunately, it opened the kimono even more on the company. And their stock, you know, as I say, I think the stock was trading about 12, 13, 14 before the restatement per share. It dropped to 5 or 6 when they announced it. After they reported out, to your point, the company didn't really kind of get the message out is, hey, this is all a fresh start, 2.0, but we've got this whole great pipe. You know, all these things are coming down the line. You know, it was just crisis management. And they didn't engage crisis management firm, which I think someone made that comment, which I apologize for missing, which could have, you know, tried to your point, let's get this, you know, little disaster behind us. But what is our message going forward? How are we going to kind of tell a story that is going to be attractive for shareholders? And that piece really kind of never happened, Brian.
Gotcha.
George, I was going to add or kind of build on what Brian just said. It seems to me, I think it's always interesting that sometimes organizations, I don't know if it's out of fear or just trying to like stem the bleeding, will just kind of do these little drips. And to me, I feel like it's a death by a thousand cuts versus just ripping it off, saying what you got to say and go into crisis management mode. It just seems like there's a hesitancy to want to do that. And I feel like it's when you report something, we made an error, mistake or whatever, you say that, you build your plan, even if the plan can't be executed immediately, I think the street wants to hear, you've got something pulled together where you're going to handle this. They'll keep checking in and their earning call and all these other ways to do it. But I just keep noticing that there seems to be, maybe if we just tell them this, there's like, seems to be people in the room who get people convinced that that's a good idea.
Ingrid, it's a great point, you know, and preceding this restatement issue for the, I'll call it the 3-4 years before that, the company was just in that grind. You know, they didn't, you know, if they had an earnings guidance out there, you know, they squeaked to get there. And, you know, now, you know, part via some errors in revenue, but they just never had that kind of wow. And so to your point, instead of dealing with things, it was like, well, okay, it's just a little cut. And the things just accumulated to where it really became, holy moly, you know, what are we sitting on here? And unfortunately, you know, when you announce a restatement, you know, it puts a spotlight on the company, but you hit the nail on the company really should have used more time to refresh what it was. You know, we're going to deal with this, but most importantly, what's going to be our message going forward? How are we going to present that we're going to be a great company again? And there never was. It was just, we're going to get through this. And, you know, for the next handful of years after, the company just continued to stumble, to be honest with you.
And that's a bad look for leaders, too, because your employee base is sitting there looking for you, the messaging out on the streets, waiting for you to kind of figure it out. So anyway, I'll be quiet.
And Ingrid, you hit it. I mean, what happens? People leave. The turnover at this company was extraordinary. Prior to 18, 24 months before the restatement, you know, if average turnover, and many of you know from an HR standpoint, you know, it's probably what, in the teens, you want voluntary and involuntary. This is a company that was tripping in the 25% to 30% across all sectors, not just finance, but sales and marketing. Again, people see a not great company. What's your biggest element of your compensation is equity, and it's not worth much because the stock price isn't moving. Let me go somewhere else. Yeah.
Does it still exist?
The company, they finally got acquired. They get a co-op, get acquired a couple of years ago, which was the best answer for the company. The company, and hopefully came through in the beginning, their products were top-notch. You know, late 80s, 90s, when they went public and everything, really had a niche, were the industry leader. But consolidation in their markets created challenges. The issues on development and getting product out there just leveled on. And the company just never, you know, kind of got ahead and probably should have found an acquirer sooner than remaining a public company for all these years, because then you almost become a public company orphan, right? Because you don't have a good message out there. To Brian, to your point, you know, you're just a $3 to $5 stock, you know, $200 million market cap for a company doing $400 million in revenue. I mean, that's, you know, not a great thing.
Did they let the CEO stay after the stock dropped so drastically?
So the CEO stayed. And ironically, what happened in this, unfortunately, I had a front seat to this because I was the managing partner of the office. It was one of our clients. I also was the advisory partner on the, and so I knew a lot of the issues going on and was trying to work with the audit committee. Mm. Prior to this, for the last few years, of just saying, hey, guys, listen, you know, we're not trying to kind of cry wolf here, but you got a lot of issues. You know, you got, you know, you're not dealing with these issues, and this before the revenue recognition, but you got inventory issues, you know, management and processing issues, you know, your systems were really, you know, there was no integrated system across the board. You know, I mean, they were like a D-plus player. And I said, you guys, and, you know, you're going to have to start dealing with it. And they'd say, yeah, we hear you. But we got these other 19,000 priorities. And okay. I mean, the end of the day, I just got to tell you. And so what's ironic on this one, and so I think, trying to remember, it might have been Jim, if you made the comment, or maybe it was John, but there was a little personality challenge between the CFO and the audit partner. And so I tried to buffer that. Every meeting two of them had, I sat in on it and played kind of negotiator. Okay, you're saying A, he's hearing B. Can we just get to some sort of an agreement? And we did that for a bit to get going, but it started escalating. And the CFO reached out and wanted me to replace the partner. And as I explained to you all before, I shared with them that this, if you know, the SEC was already looking at this, we changed the partners. It wasn't good for EY. It clearly wasn't going to be good for the company because no new partner is going to come in with a different view. I mean, the accounting issue, it is what it is. You don't like the way this partner is going to approach restatement, bring in a third party and we can figure out maybe a better path. But the person making the judgments on my side, you know, he's not a dummy. And, you know, I'll buffer and, you know, try to, you know, insulate you from having to deal with some of, you know, his thoughts. But at the end of the day, he's a smart guy and he's got the right answers. So listen to him. And the CFO was really, you know, he wouldn't accept it. Finally, I just said to him, you know, you've got a choice. It's either I'm going to be involved with my partner. We'll figure out a way to work with a third party to kind of come in and help, or, you know, you and the audit committee. And again, George Gorman, you hit at this point. The audit committee should have stood up and taken a harder stand in a couple of situations, but they didn't. But they were also just afraid of, oh my God, if we lose another CFO, who's going to come want to work at this company? Right? No one. And the CEO, if we lose him, you know, no one's going to want to come here and work. And so they changed audit firms in the middle of a restatement, which I said to him, more power to you. You think it's going to be an easy process? It took them, they were upset that we said it was going to take 6 months to get through 3 years of restatement. You wound up taking them a year with a new firm coming on board, getting their team up to speed.
They stick with the big four, George?
Yes, they did. Which surprised me, George. The CFO had a relationship with a very, very senior vice chair at one of the other big four and called in a favor, got it in, took him a year. Ironically, the CFO was out 6 months after the restatement. The audit committee did go through one or two small changes, but again, it was a situation, I think all of you hit on it. You know, you got a company in distress and it's just not producing. What do you do? And so they kind of chose what I'll call the path of easiest resistance. Let me, you know, keep my CFO, keep him happy, bring in another firm.
George, George, we're gonna have to stop.
Oh, sorry about that.
We have a time issue and people are starting to log off. I want to thank George very much for the case and the presentation. I want to thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you next month at Seat at the Table. Bye-bye. Happy Easter, everybody.
Happy Easter, everyone. Thank you.
Great job.
Bye, everyone.
Great case.
Yep, great case.